So this is just a thought experiment.
Okay.
It's not like just an intellectual exercise. It's not me saying, oh, the book would have been better this way or anything like that. It's just an experiment. So can you imagine The Count of Monte Cristo, the same book, but without The Count of Monte Cristo being a character? Like a more literary version where everything happens and they all betray a character named Edmond Dantes. But then Dantes really does go to jail and die. And then the rest of the plot is them getting their comeuppance through karma or through their own internal flaws, the same flaws that were exposed when they betrayed Edmund.
See,
and
I,
that just destroys them versus...
I was thinking that if there is no Count of Monte Cristo, these people lead... they never face any kind of punishment or judgment for their actions. That's more of a realistic look at what would normally happen with these people. That they would never get tried or brought to light what they did, and that they would just continue on with their lives, and maybe they would inflict damage on each other and try to, I think that's more likely, is that they would try to, you know, because each kind of character has knowledge about another one's past, it you know, misdeeds or whatever, so they would probably try to, you know, attack each other in that way. But I don't think there would be like a, you know, a reckoning, and they would.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's an interesting question, because, you know, in the book, it's sort of seems like the Count of Monte Cristo is a divine, you know, he has the divine justice from God to enact this revenge plot against all these characters. Now, I mean, it kind of waffles a little bit later on, but I don't know if there was a sort of like a realistic telling, or, you know, there's no revenge plot. I think it would just be a political, more political novel, I guess.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, and that's a good point, because in the book, he Monte Cristo does kind of nudge things along, but he really does kind of nudge them. Like what's fun about the mechanics of the revenge that he gets is that he kind of utilizes their own inherent flaws to bring about their downfall. And he kind of gives them a chance at redemption.
Yeah.
And they don't take it. And then it kind of is like, okay, well, I'm going to go ahead. But I was thinking it would be more literary, I think, if, you know, it'd be more serious literature. If what tied all the characters in the future together, Edmund dies, and then it's just karma kind of brings about their ruin. Not the, like, the story's perfect.
Who would then be the kind of protagonist, do you think? I would almost think it would be one of the kids in some way, or the Morell family.
Yeah, or you just show like lit scenes of how. And Edmund's betrayal is still what ties everything together, but there's just no Monte Cristo character. It's just kind of a sketch in the decline, like karma kind of brings about their downfall rather than Monte Cristo. It's a fun way to think about it.
No, yeah, it is interesting. Because if it was a more realistic or literary thing, I think, you know, I don't even know if the you know, Edmond Dantes part would be one of their many things that they did wrong.
True.
I think, you know, for the whole time that Edmund is not sort of, you know, he's in jail, or then he's sort of gaining knowledge in the East, and then he comes back into the book with kind of in Rome, seeing Albert in France. During those, you know, 15 plus years, I feel like all these characters who gain stature, Villefort, Danglars, Ferdinand, I think they all are doing, maybe, you know, maybe not working together, but they're probably doing, you know, morally corrupt things along the way.
Yeah, they're doing the same stuff that they did with Edmund. Like, Ferdinand always betrays people, Villefort crushes people in service of his ambition, and Danglars, you know.
But so I guess it begs the question, if the Count of Monte Cristo doesn't, you know, come to prominence or whatever, I don't think any of these characters face reckoning, and they just sort of leave their, maybe they have conflicts or whatever and their kids resent them and whatnot. But I don't know, in my view, if there is no Count of Monte Cristo, they lead successful lives that end with no one knowing that they're just another person who is kind of a scumbag, I guess.
Okay.
Anyway, that's a good question.
It's good. You know what it reminded me of? Tossing it in my head. Yeah. You ever seen the movie I Know What You Did Last Summer?
I have not seen that movie. I know the plot though.
Yeah, it reminded me of that. There's like I saw it way back in the day. I actually read the book too, but these four kids, two couples. They're, you know, graduate high school. They're all kind of ambitious, have their whole lives ahead of them. And they go down to the beach and have a couple drinks. And as they're driving back, they hit, you know, a pedestrian, some sort of like lost fisherman or something. And it's like, you know, like, oh crap, if we fess to it or try to help him out or whatever, they think he's already dead. And then like our lives will be ruined if we do the right thing and kind of report it and go through the steps. So they kind of, you know, bury him, you know, to move on with their lives. And then, you know, the horror.
Yeah.
So the plot is the guy wasn't dead and enacts his revenge. And these notes start showing up, like, I know what you did last summer. So it's like, oh, it'd be kind
of Monte Cristo just sending messages to, I know what you did.
Well, so imagine I Know What You Did Last Summer, where there is no hooked handed killer. It's guilt that kind of.
Oh, God. So are you seeing it more as a ghost story, like a specter in the night coming to
like haunt them? Maybe like how Eleanor was in The Haunting of Hill House.
Oh, okay.
Ghost. It's like, it'd be like a trippy,
you're tying it all together.
Magical novel where like the twist at the end of the movie is there is no hooked hand killer. All these people are going insane because guilt is tearing them apart. Oh, and there is no vengeance or no corporate entity enacting vengeance. It's just,
you know, there are, I was reading about all the adaptations of this novel and sort of not so much taking the plot, you know, scene by scene or whatever, but sort of just taking basic elements of the story. I feel like you could probably do that where you take out the kind of Monte Cristo character and then you watch, but I don't know if that's just a basic plot device, I guess. If, you know, three characters later in life, you know, are haunted by regret and the terrible deeds that they've done. I guess I'm asking, is the Count of Monte Cristo the key element making the story unique, I guess.
If you're going to try to write the story, because you're right, in real life, they just keep going and get away with it. You know, their souls would be corrupted, but... Mm-hmm. But like, if you're gonna write this story without the Count of Monte Cristo, you'd just have that be their initial betrayal. It'd be like in Citizen Kane with Rosebud. So you'd strip away all four of the characters and their downfall. Somehow you'd make the twist at the end. Like their initial betrayal is what caused their downfall.
I think, or also their betrayal of, let's say, Edmund or whatever. And they sort of have a path together, Villefort, Dinglers, and Ferdinand, of like, you know, we ruined this guy's life, we killed him, essentially. And then later on, I guess if we were right without the Count character, is they do the same thing with each other and they end up killing each other.
Yeah, yeah.
Or like, they're the downfall of each other. They just can't help themselves.
Yeah. Or a note shows up that says, I know what you did last summer. Who knows our secret? The combination, I'm going to pitch that to a movie studio. Yeah. I Know What You Did Last Summer meets The Count of Monte Cristo.
And on that note, welcome to There Will Be Books, a podcast about books and movie plots. I'm Peter, joined as always by Matt. Matt, this is part two of our discussion about The Count of Monte Cristo. And you sent me a message you want to talk about today, how the revenge plot moves along and sort of, I guess, how the kids are involved or the second generation of, mm-hmm. I guess they're secondary characters, but they're also, they flush out the story in many ways. And they also have a role in, I don't know, making it a more dynamic web of events is, mm-hmm. I guess, how I would see it. It's not just a sort of A, B, and C. If you go on, I would do this after you've read the novel, but if you go on Wikipedia, there is a kind of a graph of how all the characters are connected to each other, and there's lines drawn mm-hmm. all over, and it's just a very elaborate kind of circle graph, whatever those are called, where, you know, this person is connected to this person, this person has poisoned this person. And it's obviously a very complicated series of events that transpire. Oftentimes, me personally being like, oh man, that's okay. That's that mm-hmm. connection. It's one of those books where you go, oh, there, okay. Because I don't know for you, but sometimes I catch on to things certain times and then they get revealed and I was like, oh yeah, I knew that. And then sometimes I'm just like kind of oblivious. Maybe I don't pick up on something. And then I'm like, it is revealed, you know, exactly what's going on. I'm like, oh crap. That happened a couple times where I kind of foresaw what was going to happen. And then also I was like, oh, you know what? I don't think I caught on the clues that Dumas was giving to kind of say, hey, you know what? Mm-hmm. This character is actually these two people's kids or whatever.
Does a good job of slowly rolling it out. And yeah, there's lots of stuff there to catch. And like you, I caught some and I was kind of late to the party on some.
Yeah.
Interject. This is going to be a spoiler heavy.
Yeah.
Episode. We're going to kind of lay out the mechanics of the Count's revenge plot and then how he kind of utilizes the kids as a part of that revenge. Because mm-hmm. they're kind of like pieces on his chessboard. But we'll give a lot of stuff away. So just be forewarned or, you know, come back to it after you're going to read it.
When we did post the first one and we got some feedback where, you know, people were saying that this is one of their favorite novels. And some people said, you know, they came back to it time and time again, and you can definitely do that. I feel like you would, you know, you kind of see what's happening more, since you kind of know the plot or whatever. So definitely, planning to do that at some point. I don't know when or whatever, but there's just know that there's a lot to go on and we will spoil stuff. And part of the enjoyment of reading the book is to kind of see, you know, read that without spoilers, I guess. So
just heads up if you've read
it. Just a heads up. So where do you want to start? Which character do you want to sort of talk about the revenge of how the Count pushes?
There's a quote that'll kind of kick it off.
Okay.
From early when the Count's in Italy. And then we'll kind of go through just how each of the four people who betrayed Edmund kind of get there, starting with Caderousse, and he kind of goes in order. But so what happens is the first part of the story is the big, you know, the betrayal, and then Edmund goes to prison, you know, and escapes and then finds a treasure that allows him to be incredibly wealthy and gives him like the material means to carry out his revenge. And then more time passes and you're plopped maybe like 20 years later after the initial events of the story in Italy. And like I mentioned this last time, like episodic television, you're kind of thrown in to each chapter, not really knowing how the Count's going to play into it. You know, like, so we're thrown in, there's like a gap of 5 or 6 years where the Count kind of is off screen or off page setting up his revenge, and we're not privy to it. Things start like once he's ready to actually start moving pieces around the board. Mm. And so we're in Italy with two young men, Albert and Franz. And Albert winds up being...
I was going to tell you this. I was reading that initially Dumas wanted this section of the book first person through, I believe, Franz's point of view.
And he switched really?
It. Yeah, he just switched it. I just saw that. I saw that as a side note, and I was like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because Franz is really a secondary character. He's kind of interesting. He's sort of tied to all this stuff, but he's really an outsider in all the revenge plots. He's Albert's friend. Yeah.
He's still used as kind of a mechanism, like a window onto the Count.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you get to see how he lives his life as kind of like an oriental prince and stuff through Franz's eyes. So that's a cool way to tell a story. And I kept thinking about like the kind of prestige episodic TV that I like Westworld, whatnot. Sometimes they'll do that. You'll get like 10 or 15 minutes at the beginning of an episode where you're like, okay, I know this connects, but you don't know how yet. And then it blends in. And
no, yeah, that's a good, like that's a good point, because when we first go to Rome, we're really like, we've just been left, you know, Edmund, and now we're in a completely different
5 years later.
There's no, and there's no real, like, there's no like part two, or it's just the next chapter, you know?
Yep. Yep. And you're like, who's Ed, who's Albert?
Yeah. You're kind of left. It's the first time. And I think really the only time in the novel where it's a really, there's a jump. And it's an interesting thing that he does with the story is there's just like the large chunk of time is gone, and
and he was off in the
you know, I don't think you can debate, you know, if it's is it the correct choice, is it a bad, you know, whatever. I think it's just interesting because you're left to wonder, like, we as the reader don't know what's going on, really.
It's a good way to tell the story.
Yeah. It's a unique way too, I think.
Yeah.
You don't really see that often. So.
Right. So here's so he's in Rome. He kind of meets the Count meets these two young kids, one of whom winds up being Ferdinand and Mercedes' son. And the other one is the Baron Franz de Epinay.
Yeah. Yes. French
words. But they're both kind of connected, and they meet the Count, and the Count is kind of using them as an entrance into the Parisian society he's going to need later to enact his revenge. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you know, the first piece of the puzzle. Like, and so he takes Franz and Albert to see an execution.
Yep.
He kind of gets to talking to him. And Franz and the Count are talking about, you know, death and the justice of executing somebody who has done wrong. And, you know, Franz is saying, like, he's not sure that that's the right thing to do. And the Count says, if a man had murdered your father, your mother, your mistress, or any of those beings who, when they are torn from your heart, leave an eternal void and a wound that can never be staunched, and if he had subjected them to unspeakable torture and endless torment, would you consider that society had accorded you sufficient reparations just because a blade of a guillotine had traveled between the base of the murderer's occipital and his trapezius muscles, and because the person who had caused you to feel years of moral suffering had experienced a few seconds of physical pain? And then there's more talking, and then there's a part. It's like, are not there crimes for which impalement a la Turk, like the Turks, or a Persian burial alive, or the whips of the Iraqis would be too mild a torment, but which society in its indifference leaves unpunished?
So, I mean, that sort of hints at that he wants a drawn out, elaborate.
That's the first clue. Like, okay, this is him setting the stage for Dumas setting the stage for the Count's mindset. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is what he has in mind. And then I think by that point, you know that Albert is Mercedes' kid. And you're like, okay, so this is kind of how he's, you know, he's playing like a huge game of chess.
But he's also showing off sort of his intellect, which showing off his, just like how, I think he really identifies with the plot he has created, or the revenge plot, and it's his sole purpose in life. And I think if it was just sort of like, I'll hire three assassins to kill these three guys or whatever, and not, A, that's not really that interesting of a story, but B, to the character of Edmond Dantès, who becomes the Count of Monte Cristo, that's sort of antithetical to like what he has created.
Yeah.
Sort of, you know, on the, he considers himself almost, you know, an agent of God to enact this stuff. So I think he takes great pride in the sort of the drawn out, almost unbelievable nature of what happens in the novel.
Exactly. And that's why I like the quote so much, is because he's kind of giving his justification for what he's about to do. And yeah, how he sees himself. Like, he's kind of like mastered the sciences. So that part about, you know, instead of saying, you could just say your head was lopped off, but he says, you know, the trapezial muscle is separated from the, you know, so he's a man of science, but he's also gone to the Orient, you know, to Persia and Iraq and all that, and studied methods of torture. He's kind of adapted, they call it the Orient back then, but like Oriental ways. And so he's kind of foreign when he enters Parisian society. But that's a good, I like those two quotes so much, because it kind of like is your initial, like, okay, here's your first taste of how this guy sees himself and what he's going to go do.
And so, and then as you move along through the story, I feel like he draws these characters into the plot, Dumas, you know, through the Count. And the Count brings in these characters, and you're kind of wondering, like, what importance do they have? There's a Greek young lady that is kind of a mysterious character in Rome, and the Count calls her like his slave.
Yeah.
How she is brought into the story is much, much later. I mean, she is introduced, I don't know exactly when, but semi-early-ish in the 1200 pages. And then you don't really understand their connection and how almost every character that's introduced has a purpose in revealing the truth, I guess, or with, I can't remember what that character, the Greek character, it's basically her father was betrayed by Ferdinand. Battle in sort of, he was a traitor, I guess, in some way. And so
that's Ferdinand's main flaw, you call it. That's what he betrays people for his own advancement. And so, yeah, this whole time for hundreds of pages, he's had this Greek, he calls her a slave.
Yeah.
He doesn't treat her like that.
No. Yeah. It's sort of like, yeah, it's weird. He calls her a slave, but it's not, she sort of has all the complete freedom to do.
Yeah.
And she sees herself, I guess, as that, but that's not really kind of the plot or whatever.
Yeah. Technically, he bought her at a market, and you don't know why. She's just this character, and there's kind of hints. And then when it comes time for Ferdinand to get his comeuppance, you figure out, oh, that's what she's been doing here this whole time, you know. And Ferdinand constantly betrays people, and so the Count had kind of watched and observed. And that's, I guess, kind of one of the things I wanted to get into, because he was planning on using Albert as just a piece of his vengeance, like kind of cold-bloodedly.
Mm.
And Albert, for the most part, is a pretty good dude. He's a little spoiled because he's raised rich, but he's not terrible.
So, I mean, Albert at one point in the novel wants to have a duel with the Count because of the things that the Count is saying about his father, and it sort of puts a wrench into the revenge plot.
I found Albert to be the most insufferable leading up to the duel.
Yeah.
It resolves itself, but when initially, I guess we can go, let's go back to like, so Ferdinand is of the three main betrayers.
He's the least seen in the novel. He's
the least seen, and he's the first one kind of get his. So Ferdinand had married the Count's true love, Mercedes, and they had a kid named Albert together. What,
but I also wonder, I guess, with Ferdinand, is out of the three, his sort of reasons for what he's done, I don't know, like, are they seem the most not understandable. I think he's the most innocent, but the other two play him, or not really Villefort, but I think Dangler is just sort of controlling him. He's sort of, you know, older. I feel like he's more experienced. He's sort of leading him in a direction. He willingly goes along with it. And then, you know, later in his life, he does other things, but I feel like that's sort of the reason why there's not more scenes with him. He basically doesn't really have too many scenes with the Count.
Meanwhile, it's always
Dangliers and Villefort have tons of scenes where it's the two characters are interacting with each other. But really, Ferdinand is not, I don't know. It's if you want to say it's a flaw in the novel, I don't really see it, but he's not really there. He's not really present in a lot of the later half, I guess.
No, I think it's fine. You see that aspect of it through his kids and through Mercedes' eyes. But yeah. I like it. I think he did well. And that's kind of why he's the first of the three. Mm-hmm. But Ferdinand had basically kind of parlayed his career as a soldier into kind of wealth. And then he's a baron, I guess. Or is he,
he takes the, yeah.
And he's in the upper chamber of parliament, kind of the equivalent, I guess, to the House of Lords.
Yes.
You know, really prestigious place. And so the count had basically been engineering Ferdinand's downfall through a revelation of Ferdinand's real record of treachery. Like, the count doesn't make things up or anything. He kind of just, that's what makes it kind of poetic, his vengeance, is he just kind of reveals things that have been hidden all along.
Well, I think I said on the first one, it's all about knowledge. If he gathers the knowledge, he gets all the people that know things, and then he just sort of almost like puts them like in frame and says, you know, he lays out the case, and he does it very slowly. He doesn't rush anything. All the while he's mysterious and you know, somewhat, you know, he has the signs of the trauma of being in solitary confinement for, you know, 14, 15 years. So he has that sort of mystical aspect of himself, but he's always just slowly, and then he sets it up and he sort of shows everybody, this is who he is, Ferdinand. And Ferdinand knows he cannot continue on like this.
So he had when he was a soldier, before he was really wealthy and had this prestige, they were fighting the Greeks and the Turks were fighting a war, and France, Ferdinand went down there to fight, and they were allied with this king, and basically Ferdinand betrayed the king and sold the king's daughter into slavery. And then you find out Haiti, the Count of Monte Cristo's servant, is the king who Ferdinand's betrayed's daughter. And the Count just kind of arranges it. So there's a leak to the newspaper that the person who betrayed this king 20 years ago was somebody named Ferdinand. And they don't say who. Mm. And so the Count kind of manipulates Albert into getting offended by it. But Albert is like, what kind of made him insufferable is like, he's getting worked up about it, and he doesn't bother to find out if it's true or anything, or, and everybody's telling him like, nobody would ever think to connect this with your father except for you bringing it up. And the Count knows this and is kind of playing off that. And up until that point, the Count and Albert had kind of been kind of chummy, and you're like, oh man, is he gonna, crush Albert too? And so all this comes out, and then there's a pretty good scene where Haiti is brought to the floor of the whatever chamber it is that Ferdinand is a part of. And Ferdinand is publicly humiliated. There's incontrovertible proof that he's a traitor, and is kind of stripped bare. And it's a really satisfying like moment of vengeance. And the Count is kind of off in the distance, not really, only vaguely connected to it. He does wind up sparing Albert, kind of redeems himself.
Yeah. So that's the right thing. I mean, that's, I guess, the, you know, when we get into like the children, are there's actually, it's just interesting. Some of the kids are spared, and actually some later in the novel, you know, the Count has some, you know, have I gone too far with the case of Villefort? So I would say Ferdinand's revenge plot is sort of the most straightforward and simple in some sense. And then when you get into Villefort and Dinglaire's, they're more prominent in the novel, and it's also has more moving parts.
Mm-hmm. And there's like wrinkles that he had. It's like Maximilian,
yep.
Morcerf being in love with Valentine.
Yeah, so there are some sort of like, he has his plans, the Count has his revenge plot, and then he finds out Maximilian is in love with Valentine, which he like is like aghast at. He can't understand it, because, you know, Valentine's the daughter of his arch enemy, and
he was content. Part of his plot to get back at Villefort, who is in my opinion the most guilty, he's the one easiest to hate,
Yeah, I would say, like, I don't know. Yeah,
I could have stopped it.
Yeah.
And he knew Edmund was innocent, but he went ahead and did it for his career. But anyway, like, so, but the Count basically plants the seed of poisoning people into Villefort's current wife.
Yep. Who is a character.
Stepmother.
Yes.
And she just starts poisoning people. And you see, you know, and he doesn't come out, Dumas doesn't come out and say, here's who's doing the poisoning. You see a scene where the Count's kind of planting the seed. Mm-hmm. A really good chapter called Toxicology. Mm-hmm. And then people in the house start dropping dead. And Valentine is actually, she looks the most guilty, but you know she doesn't do it. And you know she's in love with Maximilian Morcerf, who is part of a family who the Count of Monte Cristo loves because Maximilian's father was the only person who was loyal to Edmond Dantes.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So he loves the Morcerf, but he hates Villefort. And then there's this kind of undercurrent. There's a subplot, which is kind of cool. Yeah. It kind of throws a wrench in his plans. And it's a really densely, complexly plotted story.
Yes. I think that's why it makes it so brilliant, is that there's so many layers and there's so much going on. There are secondary characters that are so interesting in how you're thinking, oh, how are they going to interact with the Count? Or, for instance, Villefort's father, kind of a mute guy who seems to communicate with Valentine, sort of the only one who can really understand him. And he seems also very smart and aware of what people's motivations are. Super interesting character. Valentine is also an interesting character. Seems like she's, you know, feels like she has no control or free will over her life.
She's innocent.
Yeah.
Monte Cristo doesn't see it because he kind of doesn't know her. She's just part of Villefort's household, and he's content to actually just let her be poisoned by her stepmother.
Yeah.
But we know she's actually an innocent person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who's in love with Maximilian, and it is fun to watch all that sort of play out.
And then you understand that Villefort and Madame d'Anglaire's had an affair, and talk about, like, it's pretty.
Well, they had a kid.
He buries a child that gets dug up from a shallow grave, and that character is brought back into the story later on as sort of Prince Andrea, which I did not see that coming.
That's where I was late to the party too.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, okay, that's the same dude. But yeah, like, so he kind of pits all these people against each other, but he kind of, one of my notes is, like, there's a lot of Shakespeare references in here.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of Macbeth, Mademoiselle Villefort, the one who's doing the poisoning, is compared to Lady Macbeth, killing people to advance the.
Well,
the,
I guess in a way, if you were to look at this, in one way, Madame de Villefort is trying to enact her own, not revenge, but she's doing something very political. So she's trying to clear out rivals for fortune and power.
She's like a wicked stepmother from a fairy tale. She's got her own son with Villefort, mm-hmm. and she's got a stepdaughter who stands to inherit Villefort's wealth. So she's trying to poison and knock off rivals to her sons. And it is actually, Dumas says.
But is that vengeance? I mean, that's just plain, what would be the word for that? It's just not like revenge. Because
not on her part.
We're all okay with what the Count is doing, right?
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, there are guilty parties, but in an interesting twist, kind of there are questions he, you know, raises to himself, like, have I gone too far, when Madame Villefort poisons herself and her son, and it's sort of like, well,
the kid is
innocent. He's just a young kid. I mean, he might be a
brat. He is a spoiled brat.
But he doesn't really deserve to be poisoned to death.
That's interesting
because you don't see too much pushback, I guess, in the Count's own mind about his plans anyway. But
he's pretty stoic about it until then. But
yeah,
I think Is vengeance on the Count's part kind of planting the seed and giving her the knowledge of how the poisons work? But for Madame Villefort, no, it's just cold.
So, I mean, is it? It's almost greed versus.
Yeah, exactly.
The Count sees it like as a divine.
He's letting people's. He would probably see it as letting people's innate nature take its course, and if he gives them a little nudge, they might have done it anyway. You know, he's just divine providence nudging them in certain ways. But the other, so there's a lot of Macbeth stuff, right? Uh-huh. Lady Macbeth. But there's also, I was reminded of Hamlet in the garden scene.
Oh, yeah.
Villefort and the Lady Danglars had an affair, and they had a kid who they thought was dead and who Villefort one night, like, goes to bury in the garden, like evidence of their crime. And it turns out, I mean, In a long series of events, it takes a couple hundred pages to sort through. Basically, the kid was not dead.
Yeah.
Somebody saw Villefort burying the child, rescued the child. The child comes back as an adult who is another part.
That person is also hired by the Count to be an assistant.
Yep. That's how on top of it the Count is.
That's how much he is a puppet master in all this.
Exactly. So there's a scene where the Count has worked his way into Parisian society and invites the Danglars and the Villeforts to a dinner at his new country house. And it just so happens to be the house where the child that Villefort buried was born at, right? So that is just really detailed part of it. And then so he winds up telling, you know, the story he tells to Villefort's face and to Mademoiselle Danglars' face, the story, the rumor he had heard.
Yeah.
About what went down at that house. And then, you know, their faces turn ashen and they're just like, how would this person know? He's like confronting them obliquely about this. And then he goes down.
But that's very Shakespearean, you know, like what you're saying. Like it's not really realistic for him to know everything that he does.
No, but he knows.
Supernatural in a way.
He does. But then he takes him down to the garden and tells them as he was digging to plant trees in his yard that he found a little child, a skeleton.
Yeah.
And he's really doing it to freak him out. And it reminded me of actually the scene in Hamlet where Hamlet puts on the play of exactly how his father was murdered to King Claudius. It's like there's a lot of Shakespearean stuff in there.
Before the revenge, that in the characters get the revenge that they've so richly deserved, the Count, it toys with them, and it's almost like he's messing with their psyches. He's like any sort of tension or past things that they've repressed, he is kind of exposing or tweaking or like just prodding at throughout, you know, 1,000 pages before any of these, you know what I mean? Like he's sort of saying, he kind of gets under their skin.
Yep.
So he's in a weird way. He's like this, like, this is not a perfect analogy. He's like a serial killer in a way that toys with their victim. Like he's, you know what I mean? He's like, he's kind of, he's smart enough. He has the funds. He's, you know, skilled with firearms or whatever to quickly dispose of these characters.
Yeah. Well, and that's part of the fun as a reader.
Yeah.
And then it goes back to the quote from earlier when he was in Italy, where, you know, it's not just enough to kill him, to put him under a guillotine. You need to, you know, kind of play with him first, because it doesn't make up for 14 years of imprisonment.
Yeah, I know.
You know, just, hey, somebody shoots you in the head, that's not the same thing.
What I think is also interesting is, I don't know, like, we're kind of taught that, you know, you don't want to really get revenge on people. It's not like a desirable thing. But this novel, I don't know, I kept thinking, like, at any point, should I not be rooting for him? You know what I mean? Should I not totally be in love with all the – but it's just so – oh, it's so great when he reveals stuff and you see the connections and you see how smart he is. And it's just like – kind of a guilty pleasure that you're seeing all this revenge happen, you know. I
think that's a big part of its lasting appeal.
Yeah,
the whole two graves thing.
Yeah.
Or vengeance from the Bible, you know, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. It's like we're kind of culturally taught, like, no, vengeance.
Yeah,
is.
Yeah.
And that probably is true in a spiritual sort of way, but it's also kind of fun to watch people who wronged an innocent person get theirs. That I think that's the nub.
I think you make a good, like, why this book has lasted and why so many people love it is that feeling of, you know, getting revenge is, you know, taught, yeah, maybe not, but so many people probably have people who have wronged them. And probably when this book came out, there were a lot of people that were lower. There wasn't like, there was probably the high end and the very low class was most people. So most people were feeling like they were getting screwed over maybe. And they were like, hey, you know what? If I could get revenge on the three people that lied and caused me to not make any money and screwed me out of a house or a job or whatever, I don't know. It just, it taps into something that humans, I think, try to hide, but is there as like an enjoying entertainment story.
And you know what, the part I wait for each time, like when each character kind of gets theirs, it's the reveal.
Oh, yeah.
You're almost kind of holding your breath. Like, okay, when he tells them it's Dante's, you want to see how they react.
Yeah.
It's fun. Cataruse with Ferdinand.
Yeah.
You're kind of like, oh, okay. You're kind of waiting.
I almost feel like you're just like smiling. You're like, yes, tell
you
them.
You are, yeah.
Tell them.
Yeah. Tell them who you are. No, that's the fun.
I think that's so fun. That's just such a fun plot line in the story. But it is not like, it's not done quickly. It's just, you know, you build up to it and you build up to it and there are, you know, other stuff. And then when you finally get to those sort of reveals and you're like, oh crap, this is awesome. Because I feel like why it's so awesome, it's so great is the whole ride up to it is so enjoyable. It's not like, oh, I just want to get to the revenge part. Mm-hmm. Oh, I just want him to tell, you know, Dinglayers, you know, he's been feeding him false information about stocks. No. Or actually before I wanted to mention Dinglayers' daughter is an interesting character in this story as sort of a person who didn't want to be set up with anybody. She had been kind of connected with other people to become married to or whatever. And then she sort of runs away and wants her own free will. And sort of this interesting aside character. Yeah. And it sort of seems like she almost has like a love affair with her teacher. In a way,
I think she kind of does.
Yeah. So they're just like interesting how the second generation doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be evil or.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's mostly
or plotting or, you know, whatever.
With the exception of Andrea/Benedito and the little bratty Edward Villafort, the other kids more or less aren't that bad. And they.
Yeah.
Save themselves or themselves. I think Danglars' daughter, though, she's interesting because the Count, kind of as an agent of divine justice, lets the kids redeem themselves. Like the actions of their parents either save them, like the Morels.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And he loves the Morels. Or Albert can kind of redeem himself in the Count's eyes. Is it Eugene? I don't know the French.
Eugene
Danglars. She wants nothing to do with her dad, even before the Count shows up. And so I think she's kind of rescued. She's allowed just to like go off stage and run away with her music teacher, which was what she wanted to do anyway. Mm-hmm. So she's kind of her ambivalence towards her father, I think, kind of saves her.
Yep.
That's her kind of function in the story, I think.
It's almost, you know, it's not the revenge story of, you know, I'm going to kill, you know, you and then your whole family. That's not what this story is about. It's sort of, these people are the people that wronged me and I'm going to kind of get close to them and pretty much their entire, the kids, the second generation, there are no, like, they don't reject what the Count is saying or plotting in a way. Albert sort of almost does. He has the sort of, you know, I'm going to duel for my father's whatever, but he eventually sees the truth.
Once he, once he's presented with the truth.
Yeah. So I guess that's an interesting, there's no like the blood bond in this story. It isn't like the final, it's more like reason and truth in a way.
Well, and I think, and the Count almost wants it to be, I think had Albert made a different decision, the Count would have killed Albert.
Yeah.
Had Albert not done that. So the Count's kind of, he's willing to let the kids redeem themselves.
I mean, yeah, he would have definitely killed Albert, I think, without.
Yeah, had Albert made a different decision, he wouldn't have let that stand in his way.
Yeah, so.
It is kind of fun how Mercedes knows who it is, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she just kind of knew automatically. And
she's a very sad character, too. Because she's, I don't know, it's just, she doesn't, I don't know, she really gets the short end of the stick here with,
yeah.
I mean, you can't really blame her for marrying Ferdinand in a way, because.
Ish. You couldn't, if it had been anyone other than Ferdinand.
Yeah, I think she would be
a little less.
Yeah.
But he, Count never has any plans to really mess with her.
No.
But he didn't, he gives her what? He gives her a little bit of money. Yeah. He even says in his note, like he could have given her more, but. He gave her his original dowry, the exact, like, I think the literally the same cash he was.
I feel like on the wedding day. Albert and Mercedes are the most sort of sad about what they've learned. They're sort of, a life full of regrets is what they're left with.
I think Albert's going to be okay.
Yeah, I guess.
I think in a roundabout way, Albert's going to be rescued from being kind of a pompous, spoiled aristocrat. I think he's gonna have to go away and find his own way in the world, and that'll wind up being better for him. Mm-hmm. That's what I took away from Albert.
I wonder if there anyone ever wrote like an Albert novel about.
Do you remember in our Flashman episode we were talking about secondary characters who you could maybe make a spinoff for?
Yeah, you definitely won.
Yeah,
there's almost like a, you could almost have a. Like the a TV show just about the kids, or like the next generation, or I don't know, like, oh, my father knew the Count of Monte Cristo, or, and then there's, I don't know, you could, I'm surprised they haven't, I think it wouldn't be as good, but I'm surprised they haven't, like they've milked this story for a long time, but I'm surprised they haven't tweaked it in weird ways.
Yeah.
If that
makes sense. Yeah, well, I was going to talk, I will talk about a little more next time with a movie episode, but the whole, when the Count's kind of off page for 6 years, going to the East and learning all about Oriental torture methods and the way they go about things, that would be an interesting
book,
side story. If you were going to do, because I'm going to advocate for a really well-done, big-budget Netflix HBO type show.
Yeah.
We just do the whole thing unabridged. There's a ton of content there. But you could add his time in the East where he's learning these skills. You could incorporate that into the story if you do it well. You know,
I think if they were to make this into, and well, I don't want to talk too much about this because we're going to talk in another episode about the movie, and we always like to talk about, you know, adaptations and whatnot. But I think if you were to sort of how I envisioned doing this is you would have the time he was in the actual jail cell with the Abe sort of as like flashbacks about what he's learning. Cause I don't know if that part of the story, it's not very long. It's only like 50, maybe you could kind of go through that fairly quickly, but I don't know if that would be like interspersed, like, oh, here's how we learned how to do this. And here's how he learned how to do like all these sort of like, how did the, you know, seemingly unstoppable force that is the Count. How did he do all this stuff? But I don't know. I guess you could, in the first season, say, hey, he found all this money.
You present it in flashbacks. Yeah.
So anything else you want to talk about?
Some random stuff. I had some stuff. We'll get to the next one, I guess. The whole Pyramus and Thisbe aspect of Maximilian and Valentine. I can talk about that.
Okay.
Next time. A couple quotes I liked. Let's see. When one lives among madmen, one should train as a maniac.
Put that
on some kettlebells. Oh, and then, so this is we talked about how it's kind of a prototype for like Batman. Or not even a prototype. Batman is derivative of this story.
Yeah.
In pretty obvious ways. But we also talked about how Sherlock Holmes, his and his deduction methods kind of, they were presented first in here by Abbé Faria in jail. And then I actually just cut this part. It's on page 845, where the Count's talking to Albert, and the Count predicts, like, having been unbidden, the Count's servant Ali comes in with exactly what Albert wanted in his head, and Albert is amazed. He's like, that's amazing. You know, that's almost magical how that works. And then the Count says, no, elementary, my dear Morcerf, which is Sherlock Holmes's exact catchphrase, elementary, my dear Watson. It was like, oh, wow. Like 50 years before, that is the exact wording of the Sherlock Holmes phrase. That's kind of cool. I mean, it's fine for Conan Doyle to do that, you know, but it's like, it's kind of obvious, like, oh, he must have really.
There are worse novels to steal from.
No, it's great. No, and it's not even theft. It's
it's just like a gentle, it's like a wink or nod, maybe.
I would be curious if it actually was, if any like scholars have kind of researched it, like how much did Arthur Conan Doyle ever, like in his letters or whatever, acknowledge
the thing. We talked about this briefly, and I went well on too much, but we talked about like what kind of novel this is or whatever. It's revenge, it's romance, it's mystery, it's literary fiction. I want to put that out there. It is as interesting and complex that, you know, as deep and sort of, you can think about a lot of different things as any other major work, I feel like.
Yeah.
It's not just action. It's not a kid's book. It's not some sort of adventure story. It is all those things, but it's not just solely based on that. I was struck almost immediately about how interesting these scenes were, specifically in the beginning of the novel with how the betrayal of Edmund is. And it's like, whoa, this is not what I was thinking. So
it speaks to people's motives, mm-hmm. which is a function of serious literature. Takes huge themes, helps you explain the world. There's a lot in here about power and ambition and how power and ambition corrupt your soul. Or I think you're right.
Yeah, and also like money. Hey, these Dinklage feels like he has a lot of money. Guess who has more money than him? The Count.
Yeah.
And that fact itself makes Danglars feel uncomfortable and feel sort of less of a person. Just the fact that the Count goes, certain amount of money that he can loan, oh, that's all, or, you know, whatever. It's an interesting look at when a rich person meets a wealthy person, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
The rich person will be like, oh, crap, I actually don't.
Yeah.
It's all been, anyway.
Yeah. Well, and because they're so money obsessed, it actually bothers them.
Yeah.
Danglars's psychology that the Count can turn around and.
It's something where like Maximilian or the Morel family is grateful for a gift of money or whatever. They're not, it's not a danger to their like family standing or whatever. They're just, oh, wow, this is a great. Anyone else, Villefort, Danglars, it's like, oh, that's a rival now. I have a lot of money, but this person has more money. So I don't know. That adds to the element of revenge and kind of them. So any other thoughts, Matt?
Let's see. No, nothing that is urgent for this time.
I will say this was my book of 2020. This is my favorite book I read last year. One of my favorite books I've read. I don't know where I put it. It's top 10, I'd say.
It's up there.
I would put it up there.
I think it's in my top 10 too. It really is that good. Yeah. It's a good book.
Highest recommend to anyone. So
give it a shot.
Give it a shot. Matt, we're on the social media everywhere.
Yeah.
We get mail. No, I'm just kidding. We get email at, what is our email? willbebooks@gmail.com. Send us a note about if you've read this book, what you thought about it, how you would adapt this novel, how you would you leave out, what would you have everything, I think when we watch the movie, I think they leave a lot out because it's 2 hours long.
Oh yeah, they have to. Well,
yeah. So I was like, I think it's gonna bother me a little bit. Be like, that character, I don't know.
I'm gonna try to give it the benefit of the doubt because I know a lot of people. I've talked to two people who are like, I really like the movie.
I know.
I'm gonna give it.
I have to remember, it's hard to adapt. You can't adapt 1,200 pages into 2 hours. So that was the challenge they were given. So let's see.
But we're gonna, next time, part three is gonna be, we'll wrap up the actual book and then we'll
talk
about it. And we're gonna cast it.
Yeah.
So you send us in if you have any casting ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. Casting call and movie review. So we're also on Instagram where we post pictures of books in a very artistic and very cool way. So head on over there and you'll see what we're reading. I just actually have finished two. I talked about one a week or so ago, but I finished another new novel, which I'll put a picture up of and talk about in a later episode. But that's where we kind of put pictures of what we're reading, what we're kind of interested in, all that kind of jazz. We're also on Twitter. Matt is the king of Twitter. He got off onto a football.
Live tweet football.
He live tweeted a football game. He said he regretted it in some ways. I said,
no, I don't regret it.
I
regret nothing. But I didn't get responses. It's
like, hey.
But it's fun. I'm going to be live tweeting the Super Bowl.
Yep.
Look for that.
Between those two teams. So look for that. But also, you can also check out, maybe we'll post quotes about books and whatnot. We also have, what else do we have?
Ko-Fi,
which is a way you can support the podcast by giving us a tip donation. And we will also soon be having a Patreon account. So those are kind of our social media ways to get in contact with us.
One more thing. Speaking of Instagram, yep. And actually speaking of Hamlet, our Instagram buddy is an author named Luke Swanson.
Okay.
Written, I think his debut book, his first book, called The Other Hamlet Brother.
Okay.
He's kind enough to send us a PDF copy.
Oh, nice.
It looks pretty good. It's like, you know, like if Hamlet had a brother and I don't know.
Very exciting. Thank you, Luke. Appreciate it.
I'm looking forward to giving it a go. And it's out, he said February 11th.
February. The Other Hamlet Brother.
The Other Hamlet Brother should be everywhere books are sold.
All right, yeah. We always like to support authors and up-and-coming authors and whatnot. So we're glad to do that. So check that out. Until next time, we will talk to you soon.